Welcome to the NASCAR on NBC podcast. I'm your host, Nate Ryan. Our guest this week is Brad Keselowski, the 2012 Sprint Cup Series champion. As always, Brad had much to say and was well said in answering my many questions. So we're going to get right to it after this brief preamble. I think Brad is one of the best interviews in NASCAR, and that's because, especially in this kind of setting, when he has time to mull what's being asked, he will give you some of the most articulate, insightful, and thoughtful answers. His candor sometimes has gotten him in trouble. You'll hear me reference a 2013 USA Today sports story that earned him a reprimand from NASCAR after he was outspoken in sharing his vision for moving the sport forward as the reigning champion. But Brad's willingness to be forthright greatly is appreciated, particularly in a wide-ranging talk such as this one. Among the things we touched on, the mini-controversy he was involved in at Pocono Raceway Monday, and whether he felt his team deserved the penalties received, his thoughts on NASCAR TV coverage and journalism, his role in the Sprint Cup Drivers' Council and how it's made things easier in trying to be a steward of the sport, the Sprint All-Star Race format he helped devise and why he was surprised by some of his peers' reactions to it, and his love for having grown up in Michigan and how it shaped him. NASCAR heads to Michigan this weekend, and Brad likely will be paying a visit to his hometown of Rochester Hills in the greater Detroit area. As always, we appreciate you listening. Please leave a rating or review on iTunes or send me feedback on Twitter at Nate Ryan. And without further ado, here's our conversation with Brad Keselowski. Okay, joined by Brad Keselowski, who has been kind enough to give us some of his time here on a Tuesday afternoon, which we appreciate. And Brad, as I just mentioned, the first question I have for you, I'm looking at my Twitter before the Coca-Cola 600, and photo pops up of you with your weight, which has become your thing, I guess. Is this your thing, by the way, before races?
What makes something a thing?
You've done it before, right?
I have done it before, but only once before.
Okay.
If you do something twice, is it now a thing?
I guess now it's a thing. I feel like I had seen you do this before.
I have multiple done it before, okay. But I feel I'm hung up on what makes something a thing now. There's probably someone listening right now that could define when you go from something you've done before to something you do regular enough for it to be a thing.
I guess for me, a thing would be, yeah, if it's something that happens, well, apparently I've defined it as multiple times in your instance.
So this is the second time I've done it.
I guess the second time you have done this. I thought it was more, but I'm probably just overwhelmed by all the drivers flooding my Twitter with pre-race photos of
I have no idea how you keep up. I really don't.
It's a full-time job, man.
Yeah.
All right, so before the Coca-Cola 600, you tweet your weight, and it says 191 on the screen. And I'm thinking, I mean, I got obsessive.
You got obsessive about this?
About my weight. I got obsessive about my weight about 3 or 4 years ago. And so, like, I know, like, what I weigh, like, soaking wet. Fully clothed. And I'm looking at this photo of you. Obviously, I can't see you, but you have a fire suit on. And I'm thinking, Brad Keselowski weighs 191 pounds in a fire suit. And I'm thinking,
fully dressed.
He's got rocks in his pockets, or he's like, I don't know, holding
a steering
wheel.
You that there's a couple pieces of the equation for this story that, and unfortunately, I can't comment on one or two of them, although they will become clearer in a week's time.
Okay.
So there's an unfortunate circumstance of timing for this podcast to where I can't fully answer it. But long story short, my goal, or one of my goals, it's not my only goal in life, but one of my goals this year was to put on about 20 pounds.
Okay. Okay. And that objective will be revealed at a later date. Because I noticed, because then I did a lot of research for this, as I tend to do with these podcasts. I'm obsessive about these as well. I went through your Twitter and noticed at some point you kind of made reference to this, that you were trying to put on some weight.
So wow, you really did do a lot of reading. Wow.
I feel like I got to be prepared.
Yeah, I don't even remember that.
You had made some reference, which surprised me because, you know, normally I'm used to seeing you a little more, a little less bulked up than 191 pounds.
Am I bulked up? Do I look bulked up?
Now that I'm looking at you, you look like, so you've put on some weight since the beginning of the year.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And we'll learn at a later date how many pounds and for what reason and all those things. Okay.
Now, well, pounds, the target is 20 and I'm not far off it, but I'm not there yet.
What kind of, can you tell us what kind of working out you do?
you're doing there?
I don't really like to talk about it. Yeah, I don't want working out to be my brand. I don't understand those that do make working out their brand, to be honest. I feel like it's for me and it's for my team, and maybe I'm selfish. I just don't want to share it.
Yeah, I can respect that. Big day for you and Joey Logano at Pocono yesterday in the rain-delayed race. You guys both came back from adversity to score top fives, and again showed Team Penske's strength. One way I've heard Penske's strength described, Brad, is as stacking pennies. Meaning, yeah. I've heard that phrase a lot for some reason in reference to your team in particular. Meaning that improving a car in the Sprint Cup Series has become such an incremental exercise that it's never defined by one thing. It's that you have to add up all of these things, and that no one change is going to help. It's going to be many that is going to have a significant impact. I guess my question to you is, like, you know, where does that originate? How did that philosophy become a thing for you at Team Penske?
It's definitely a thing. I think Joey Logano used that quote, but honestly, I'm not sure if he got it from me or if he had heard it somewhere else, or maybe we just stumbled upon it together. But the first time I ever heard that quote was at Hendrick.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah. So it was one of the philosophies that I would say I thought about, at least when I came to Penske. I remember the first time I looked at one of the Penske race cars when I came in the fall of 2009 to drive for them. And we were looking at it, and I was like, yeah. And I tried to explain to the people that were working on it, like, what's different and what it looks like and what could potentially be not as strong as the Hendrick cars at the time, which were quite a bit faster at that time. And the items I brought up to them, they looked at me and they were kind of like, they gave me that, I don't want to say condescending look, but just kind of a look where you're like, yeah, that doesn't do anything. And it's hard to explain because I could pick out 25 items that in each one of them, someone would say, well, we tried that and that didn't show up. And we tried that and that didn't show up. And I'm like, yeah, but did you do all of them?
Right.
All of them together
right.
do something. And to try to have that conversation is challenging. So it has to really, start as a philosophy that works its way through your team. And it's one that I think sometimes is easily missed. It's, just details in preparation. But it goes across the board, whether it's in the car or the driver, the team, whoever it might be.
It sounds like, obviously, because it somewhat originated with you and Joey, you would have
heard that
phrase before.
I don't want to take all the credit for it. I mean, I'm the driver. I get like 90% of the credit and do 10% of the work. It's in complete inverse of what it probably should be. So I don't want to take all the credit for it, but I do believe in it.
As a driver, though, it would seem to me, I mean, your whole goal is you just want to go as fast as possible, as quickly as possible. So how do you, I guess, turn your brain around and think of it in that way, that it's not that there are no, maybe I'm looking at this too simplistically, but like when I think about like when drivers are trying to improve their cars, it's just give me the change that's going to make me go faster. How do you guys like approach it from, we know it's going to take this little thing here, this little thing here, this thing underneath the car, this whatever tweaks that you guys don't tell us about. How do you guys just put faith that all of those things are going to come together and make your cars faster? Mm.
Well, it's an extremely difficult conversation and mindset to get to. But I think over time, as a driver, there's a lot of factors that come together. And we talk about momentum and confidence and all those things in this sport and why they're important. That's one of them. It's one of those reasons is you have to believe in the people around you, and you have to let, I like to maybe oversimplify, you have to let smart people do smart things and realize that if you're the team engineer, you probably don't know what it takes to do the best pit stop. And if you're the jack man, you probably don't know the best part that needs to go on a race car. And if you're the driver, you don't know the best part that goes on a race car. But then again, if you're the engineer, you probably don't know the best line around the corner. And so you play to strengths over time because you have confidence in those that are in other categories on your team. I think that's really what a team sport is. But trying to evolve is challenging because you also know that if you stand still, you're going to get passed. And of course, I mean that figuratively and literally. And so you can't have 100% confidence in the things you've done, mm-hmm. or you would never grow. You would never change. You would never adapt. But you have to have just enough confidence to believe in the people you're around. It's really this tricky kind of, I don't know what the right word for is, paradigm, perhaps is what comes to my mind. And so finding that balance is so critical. And you can walk both sides of it. And really, neither one of those sides is successful long term. But I think trying to add to the conversation, you know, how do you get there as a team? How do you get there as a driver beyond the confidence and the balance of, you know, knowing that you have to believe in the people you're around but continue to grow and adapt? One of the things that I would add to this conversation beyond that is that the same things don't work every week. You know, if you go to Loudon in the spring and you say, all right, we got a good setup there. And you say, all right, we were just a little bit too tight in practice and we raised the track bar. And, oh, now we got the balance of the car right, picked up a little bit of speed, great. You say, all right, well, what's the next flat 1 mile track? Phoenix. You might make the same adjustment and it doesn't work at all. And it's such a head scratcher for the teams.
Right.
There's no other sport, and I like to say this in a lot of our settings that we, you know, where we do driver interviews, but there's no other sport that I can think of where the field or the playing surface, whatever you want to call it, changes every week. You know, in football, you know the field's going to be 100 yards long. I think it's 58 and a half feet wide. You know, hockey, same arena. Basketball, same arena every week. And baseball, there might be some small nuances to the field as to, you know, you got, you know, the monster at Fenway and some of those. But they're relatively small nuances. They're huge nuances in racing.
Right.
You know, the difference between Watkins Glen,
right.
Talladega, Bristol, and, you know, Charlotte is immense.
Right.
And so you have to continuously adapt to the track and adapt to the car, and the same things don't work. And so you just have all these things that are pulling against you. And to answer your question in depth, I would say that those are the things I think of.
Pocono versus Michigan, there's a half-mile difference, but can you even – yeah. Begin to explain what the difference would be between trying to go fast this past Monday versus this coming Sunday?
Well, you know, Pocono is much more a compromised setup because you have three different corners.
Right.
And Michigan is not a compromised track. You don't use the brakes at Michigan nearly to the extent you do at Pocono. And so the way the car travels is completely different. The loads on the tires, the loads in the suspension is different. It's just so many different things week to week.
Right.
And that's a perfect example.
Right. As I told you, I've been doing a lot of preparation for this, and I was looking back through a lot of my Brad Keselowski notes and interviews from the last 5 years, and one that I found that kind of surprised me was like, I should have marked where it was, but it was essentially that you were talking about that your wins rarely are without controversy.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about that yesterday when I'm like, okay, I've got this interview scheduled with Brad Keselowski, like what is going to happen in this race that will lead me into a controversial subject matter that
I didn't win, but I also didn't let you down.
Well, yeah, you came close to winning. I mean, what you said, five or so more laps, you might have won that race.
Yeah, I think we certainly had a shot at it. I couldn't quite make one of the key passes early in the run I needed to make to put pressure on, but you know, it just is what it is.
So the controversy, it didn't even occur to me until like the second or third story I read about this, that you and Jeff Gordon had a thing 2 years ago.
That qualifies as a thing.
That qualifies as a thing, right?
In my mind, that's a thing.
All right.
You had There's that. Somebody who fast forward to this podcast, to this part, who has no idea what we're talking about. And I'm just going to go ahead and tell you need to rewind to the start to understand what we mean. So... Anyway, that was my shameless plug for you,
I
Nate,
appreciate
to
that,
listen
Ben.
The whole podcast.
I appreciate that because I do time cues for these podcasts so that for easy reference, if they want to like just go to a certain spot, for example, hey, here's what we talk about Brad Keselowski and Jeff Gordon and what happened after the
race. And you
may
want to rewind to the start to understand what a thing is.
Yeah. So you and Jeff obviously had a thing at Texas a couple of years ago, which I had totally forgotten about. And again, until I was reading a story last night and somebody had framed this, the back and forth you guys had after that race. So I'll just give you a chance to address it. What you said about him and TV commentators in general, do you feel as if, is there too much, it's not that there's too much cheerleading, I think, right? I think what you're saying is that there's too many potential conflicts. Is that kind of what you see there?
Well, I see a lot going on there, and it's, you know, a broader story than, I think maybe where a lot of people have taken it, and that's okay. You know, everybody. One of the beautiful things about our world that we live in as human beings is that everyone sees the world differently, and that's why it's, you know, part of the fun, I think, of living this life is knowing that you and I can watch the sun rise tomorrow and we'll probably see 10 different things. And that makes us all unique and fun. On the other side, it's inherently very frustrating.
Right.
And so I get frustrated by the conversation because I don't understand why people can't see things sometimes the same way I do. But I try to remember what a blessing that is. But I think looking at this topic in broad strokes, you know, the media landscape has changed dramatically, not just in motorsports, but across the world. In the short period of time in which I've been in existence on this planet, and I would say that I think what we're seeing is different standards, arguably much lower standards of what is acceptable in journalism, and that's what a TV broadcast is to me. It is a form of journalism. You might see it maybe a little differently than I do there, but then that's okay.
No, it's storytelling.
It's storytelling.
It's intended
it's a different kind of journalism than what most people think, but I would say that a sports broadcast is a form of journalism.
Yeah, I agree.
And there are certain standards that, you know, I believe in. Journalism is a funny thing for me because I see it from two different sides. One, I see it from a participant who has stories wrote about him. And in that setting, it's very interesting, especially this time of year when you have election season, that I read stories about myself or even the sport in general where I have in-depth knowledge of what's going on and all of the specifics. Sometimes, you know, I can't share all the specifics because there's reasons that create limitations. But then I can read a story, and even if it doesn't specifically involve me, but it involves the sport, and I can read stories and look at them and say, oh my God, that's 100% wrong. How could he even write, or he or she write this? And it's funny because that has transcended into other areas of my life, and we talk about this all the time internally at our team, or in our team at Penske, that watching the election news cycle right now has us so jaded. Because we just automatically assume that the landscape in politics or government or whatever you want to call it is just as skewed as it is in motorsports. And so we watch the news and go, well, I think I know, but I'm pretty sure that if their media landscape runs like our media landscape, then this is entirely wrong. So you know what? I don't know. And so it's an interesting dynamic, but trying to, you know, maybe focus the conversation a little bit more. I have some strong beliefs of what I think the code of journalism should be in motorsports. I don't think they're necessarily popular beliefs, and most times I try to keep them to myself because it's not productive. But the setting of this week changed how I felt about it because I felt like it was a direct attack on myself and my team. And so perhaps I was a little more vocal than what I would have liked to have been. Doesn't mean I don't believe what I said, but it's also a bit of a struggle to maybe frame that in a way that would make sense to everyone, and I understand that.
For you, journalism in motorsports, like what are the prime directives there, do you think? I mean, what should be the guiding principles?
Guiding principles, wow. I mean, I think if you can follow journalism 101 from high school, you'd be off to a really good start. And you know, I said that I see it from two different sides. That's the second side that I see it from, is the kid. You know, when I was 16 or 17 years old and in high school, I took journalism classes. I was fascinated by journalism. I think that's part of why I write the blogs, because mm-hmm. It's my own chance to be a little bit of a journalist. I don't have a lot of time for it, so they get released every so often. Someone else does all the editing on them, and it's like, but I still have that craving to want to do it,
right?
Because I love it. I love storytelling. I love factual storytelling. I should be clear on that. But I think if you can pass the high school 101 litmus test on journalism, you're doing a pretty good job.
Speaking of journalism as it relates to yesterday's race, one question that I had that I didn't feel like got answered, and that this isn't an indictment of the people who are asking the question. Sometimes in the post-race frenzy, it's hard to get sure. to the truth.
It's hard. Not only is it hard for the media to think of all the right questions to
yes.
ask,
mm-hmm.
it's hard for the interviewee to give a complete context answer, because
right.
you get like halfway through your answer and you know somebody walks up and pats you on the back, or
right.
somebody walks in with another microphone and bumps you on the shoulder, and you're like, huh, what?
Right.
Wait,
right.
what were we talking? Like, you
right,
get
right.
so distracted.
Right.
And so one of the many frustrations I have with that is I never feel like I give a full context answer, and I always leave those settings disappointed by myself that, like, why didn't you think of this to finish the answer? And why didn't you, like, you never
yeah.
finished it.
Yeah. Well, if it gives you any solace, and I doubt it will, I always leave every interview thinking, why didn't I ask that question?
Yes,
I always go back and forth on, like, what's harder, being the interviewer or the interviewee? And
I think they're both kind of
I still think it's probably tougher being the one being interviewed than the one asking the questions. But I mean, you're right. It's very perceptive that you pick up on that. And the one thing I didn't really pick up on yesterday was that did you think your crew had committed an infraction?
I didn't know in the car.
Okay.
You know, I think having the benefit of, you know, a day removed, I have a lot more, you know, facts. I would say that if I was NASCAR, I would have done something.
Mm-hmm.
And to clear that up, I would say I would have done something that was NASCAR, not because the damage that was done was impactful, but because you have to draw the line somewhere. I did have the benefit, like I said, of seeing the damage that was done to the car by the 48 after the race,
right.
but not the benefit after the race of seeing what had happened on the pit stop. Once I got to see the footage from the pit stop, I saw that there was no real significant damage. But the guy, he still made the move. And I would kind of equate it to, right now, football is the most popular sport in America, so I'll use a cheesy reference, you know, forgive me later. But I would kind of draw an equivalence to holding on the other side of the field if it was football.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, did it impact the play or the race? Absolutely not. Was it wrong? Yes. So, you know, the other reason why I would, you know, probably draw an equivalence to holding in football is that there's probably holding on every play.
I was about to say, and every team is
every
probably
team,
doing it, right?
Every play.
Yeah.
So you have to draw the line somewhere, and if I'm NASCAR, I agree with them drawing a line.
Yeah.
I, of course, hate that it was us, but they have to set a line. But to label it maybe as cheating, I mean, if you think holding in the NFL is cheating, then yeah, I guess that's cheating.
Right.
I can prefer the word fouls because I think that more describes the situation. It's better articulation, but you know, it's kind of handled and moved on.
This of course speaks to how important aerodynamics are with the cars these days, and we recently did a shop tour at Team Penske right before they sent the cars to Indianapolis. You were there, as was Simon Pagenaud and Will Power, And you gave us this.
Don't forget Ryan Blaney.
And Ryan Blaney.
That poor kid gets left out of everything.
Sorry.
Like anytime he shows up somewhere, he's like, no one even asks me questions.
Do you think he gets self-conscious? He doesn't seem like
the
type he would.
Yeah, he
really?
Does get self-conscious.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. I don't know if you noticed, but the back half of the shop tour, I had to walk away so he could run it.
See, this is terrible. I didn't notice that.
Yeah, it's like eventually you're kind of like, all right, I'll walk away so Ryan can.
Okay. Well, this is not to slight Ryan, but like the most memorable part of that shop tour came from you. He did his job with aplomb, but like you gave us the first half in which you were kind of explaining how the cars went through all these stations. And one thing that you said that really struck me was that you compared another analogy, like holding in football, you compared Sprint Cup cars to being transformers.
Yeah.
In which we're talking about like the car, the cartoon, the movie where these cars transform into something else when they get on the racetrack. Could you explain what you mean by that and why that is?
Well, there's a complex system of rules measurement that NASCAR has to try to keep the cars in a box for competitive reasons, parity, et cetera. Because you have to have some kind of box. And they've refined that box over the years with different systems. There's laser measurement systems. There's template systems with intricate grids and tolerance systems of, 200 thousandths or less, some parts all the way down to, thousandths of an inch. Of course, we have to pass that system before the race, but being that it's a piece of machinery that travels at 200 mile an hour, it's very unrealistic, no matter what the circumstance is, for that vehicle to return and fit all those tolerances. So, NASCAR picks what they call hard points or key points, would maybe be another way of looking at it, and they say that these points must pass unless you have significant race damage. These points don't have to pass after the race. So there's kind of those two criterias. There's the don't have to pass, and there's the have to pass except for. And so what you find is, since both of those points have to pass before the race, the ones that don't have to pass before the race are built by the race teams to transform. It would be the easiest way to explain it, to transform into ways that generate a competitive advantage. That's not just at Team Penske, that's in right. all of the sport. An easy way to think of it that doesn't apply now to Sprint Cup racing but still applies to the Xfinity and Truck Series is you see the cars as they roll out on the grid and the front end is 5 or 6 inches up in the air, and when they go around the track, it's flat. That's one example of a transformer in suspension. So the suspension collapses on the track and the air pushes it down and holds it down, and once it gets to slow speeds, it pops back up. NASCAR Sprint Cup doesn't have that rule anymore because they got rid of their height stuff. But the bodies are the same way on the race car would be an easy analogy that does carry over. And so the bodies change shape, and you have the hard points that are supposed to pass after the race unless you have significant race damage. And that's where we run into guys that run in the wall after they won a race, or drive through the grass after they won a race, or do a burnout after they've won a race, where they're significantly impacting the hard points that are supposed to fit after a race.
The crazy wiggling that we see after qualifying.
Yeah, the crazy wiggling is another example. Yep. Yeah, that one's a little different because the crazy wiggling isn't done to get a hall pass. Yeah. It's done to reset the cars to fit. The hall pass is only when you have race damage.
I see.
So think of it in all those things. So when those cars transform in areas that don't have to pass after the race, they do permanent damage to the cars. So you have to replace all those panels anyway.
So this gets to the point of why not change the tolerances. And I think that you kind of explained, well, for one, you explained during the shop tour that after every race, and I saw Rodney Childers tweeted this as well, that this is not certainly unique to Team Penske, this is what everybody does, that after every race that you got to take off the body and redo it, so why not just scrub the car all the way down to the suspension point? So after every race, every car gets redone and turned into another transformer, basically.
Which is always funny because I've had a few things over time where maybe I've, after a race, rubbed somebody or bumped them, and they play the whole, I can't believe you damaged my car after the race, now the guys have to fix it card. And this
They're
goes
fixing it anyway.
Yes, exactly. This goes back to what I just said a few minutes ago about media and journalism. Like, I can't believe someone would even print that because it's so bogus. But people will say things like that because they know that someone will print it and completely buy in without checking it.
Right.
And next thing you know, there's a headline of, you know, donut on such and such's car after the race cost, you know, XYZ team $20,000 to fix. And you're like, oh my God, come on.
Yeah.
It is what it is. I understand it. I mean, I like it.
Yeah. So, and I think this gets into when you were telling us about the whole steel versus composite debate. Does that kind of play in all this? Like, why doesn't NASCAR just change the tolerances and make it easier? And it kind of goes to a lot of that.
Yeah, right? There's a lot of pieces there. One, you have to have a box and it has to be somewhere. And I would say, two, the teams are going to take advantage of it no matter what the rules are.
Right.
And the third category is manufacturer relevance. You know, composite bodies would probably keep us a lot closer to NASCAR tolerances and so forth. But we run into issues of relevancy to what you have on the street, which is, for the most part, our cars are still made of steel.
Right.
On the street. And on the racetrack.
Shifting gears away from the track and still pertaining to what you do in NASCAR, but more from a leadership standpoint, the Drivers' Council.
Everybody likes to talk about the Drivers' Council. Well, I'm kind of surprised it's such a topic.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of fascinating because
Is it fascinating? I don't understand it.
Because it's never really happened before in this sort of
It's fascinating format. Because it's new?
Yes. Well, here's why it's fascinating to me. So when I got you in trouble 3 years ago, and in my previous life...
It was four, but who's counting?
Well, three and a half. Daytona 2013, when I got you
in trouble... Okay, it was three and a half.
...for writing The World According to Brad Keselowski cover story in my previous life as a USA Today sports writer. at that time, like, people got really hung up on the fact that you had all these ideas, I think, about wanting to affect change in NASCAR. And one of the things that I thought really got overlooked at that point was your reason why. It wasn't like some shameless power grab. You wanted to affect change in NASCAR because you saw it as an opportunity to be a steward of the sport. So I think everybody got really hung up and caught up in, oh, look at what Brad Keselowski wants to do.
That seems to happen a lot to me where people get hung up on really small points to big, broad statements that I might make. And it's again, mind-boggling to me, whether it's the example of this past weekend with the booth or broader than that.
Well, I think your intention, here's my perspective, just my opinion. I think your intentions are always good. And sometimes I think people get caught up sometimes in the content. And so bring the Drivers' Council into play. What I see with this is, has it somewhat inadvertently allowed you to play the role that you wanted to play when you were the reigning champion? When I talked to you for that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's not just that I wanted to play the role. You know, here's what I see in the sport. We have huge challenges. It's not just in motorsports. It's not just in NASCAR. It's in every sport. We have a huge challenge in front of us. You know, football is doing well. I think we tend to compare ourselves to football and basketball, maybe too much even. But even it's got some huge challenges. You know, there's still a fair amount of games that don't have full crowds in the NFL. They get blackouts. They got issues with kids that aren't playing anymore with respect to concussions. So every sport has some issues, but a lot of the issues that are starting to really come up is the next generation. Mm-hmm. The next generation, as I see it right now, is not a sports generation. And so that's a heck of a challenge for us, and not just us. Somehow we have to bridge that gap with motorsports. Now we have a couple advantages, and we have a couple disadvantages to doing that. One of our advantages is that you know, we have more of a story to tell than just our drivers or our pit crew members. We have a story to tell with the manufacturers. Mm-hmm. And so that gives us a technology aspect that doesn't necessarily exist in other sports. So that's an advantage. We have some disadvantages too, where, you know, we're kind of caught up in a concept, or maybe not even a concept, but I feel like we've been pigeonholed by a lot of groups as a southern sport, a regional sport. I don't feel that way. And there's only a handful of drivers left in the sport that are from the South. I'm not that there's anything wrong with that, but I think of us as a national sport. So we have some advantages and disadvantages to kind of cover. But I think in general, back to the Drivers' Council and that meeting and all those things, we have to find a way out of these challenges if this sport is going to maintain or grow. As a champion, whether it's current, past, or maybe even future, I think every driver has a role of trying to make sure that their sport stays relevant beyond themselves.
Right.
And when I think of the Drivers' Council, it doesn't have a mission statement. It doesn't have any of those things. But if I was to try to create a mission statement, one of the first things I would think of putting in that mission statement is that we're going to do things for the sport that probably won't help it in our time in it as drivers. And that's so hard to do because we get caught up, I think, thinking small term of what can we do to be better tomorrow? And that's important, but the big stuff is where are we going to be in 10 years?
Right.
And so the council gives us a format to have these really big conversations to find solutions. And it's my belief that the solution isn't going to come from one person. It's not going to come from one person in NASCAR. It's not going to come from one driver. It's not going to come from one track owner or representative or one sponsor, one car owner. It's going to come from a collective group.
Right.
And having these councils and these formats is how we're going to get that collective group to come up with that answer.
And you're right. It's an inherently selfish sport, so that's hard to think in those terms. But again, like this is what when you were talking about some of the stuff that you talked about in your champions speech in Vegas or in that interview 3 years ago, to me, this is the stuff you want to do. It's the stewardship of NASCAR, as you just said, right?
Well, and
it's
my goal one day, Nate, to be honest, is I'd love to be in the NASCAR Hall of Fame. What a shame it would be if that Hall of Fame didn't exist because we didn't guide the sport in the right way in our generation.
Right, right. So this is allowing you to do that in a way that you couldn't.
And I think I'd like to think so. Yeah. I mean, I guess time will tell if it's a success or failure. I think there have been some successes, you know, some wins put on the board would maybe be the term. But, you know, the big win is for a sport to maintain or grow despite the enormous challenges it'll have over the next two decades. That'll be the big challenge.
You asked another reason why people might be fascinated by the Drivers' Council is Dale Jr. is on it.
That's a good point, yes.
And he also happened to put you in the crosshair a little bit in terms of the All-Star race format.
Yeah.
Did you mind being sort of like identified as the person who that was? Sounds like that was your brainchild pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of pieces to that, and I had some of the ideas for it, but not all of the ideas for it.
Mm-hmm.
There were some things that I thought went really well. There were some things that I would admit didn't go really well. But in general, I feel like it was a success, even though there's probably a lot of people listening that don't, in moving our sport forward and opening up a box. What we couldn't do is go back. We couldn't go back to the rules package from 2013 or 12. We knew that was a failure. We can't go back to the rules of 1992 because it's not 1992 and the cars don't drive the same way and the tires don't react the same way and the racing wouldn't be the same. We needed to come up with a new format that took advantage of the situations that our sport fights or the hands that it's dealt. And I feel like for the most part we did. There was some small hiccups that I think everybody wishes could have been handled a little bit differently, maybe through forethought or reaction at the time. But to me, the key part when I thought about the race is I thought about the race in two contexts. One is what race would I sit down and watch if I was a fan or buy a ticket to sit down and watch, whether it be on TV or in attendance. And the other was, what format would I be proud of winning if I won the race? And I felt like if I could answer those two pieces, that the race would be a success. And I would tell you that it's my impression, even though Joey hasn't directly said it to me, it's my impression that under those two guiding lights, the All-Star race hit mm-hmm. both of those.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those are the two things that should matter the most.
Right. Right. I would consider it a success based on just the third segment, just based on what we saw and the race for the lead and the battle for the win. And if you had to break some eggs on the way making that omelet.
Yeah. Nobody likes that you had to break eggs. I mean, it wasn't perfect. I'd be the first one to tell you that. But
yeah.
I don't know how you can, and maybe I'm stuck on this spot myself, but I don't know how you can call a format a failure because an 11th place guy that never was going to have a chance of winning got stuck a lap down.
Right.
I don't know. That was a kind of a first for me. An 11th place guy that under no format in the history of the All-Star race would have a chance of winning got stuck a lap down. I'm trying to think. I can't wrap my brain around how that constitutes a failure when you had a great battle for the lead in the last segment.
Right.
Like that was all part of the format. So I thought that was strange. I felt like there were a number of people who didn't embrace the format, and they ran like they didn't embrace the format.
Yeah.
And that blew me out of the water. I just can't understand it, Nate. I can't understand why somebody, because I look at that race as a chance to win $1 million and a really cool trophy and you know, kind of establish yourself or reestablish yourself if you've already won it before as an all-star, the all-star. And for someone to come into that race, which clearly was the case based on the narrative of probably half a dozen teams, but for someone to come into that race not prepared for it, not embracing it, and then have the results that those teams did just blew my mind. really did.
Well, that goes back to, I guess, the adage of driver shows up at a road course thinking he can't win.
It just amazed me that a simple format change like that made drivers feel like they couldn't win.
It
blew me out of the water. I look back at the year before that, 2015 All-Star race. I led the most laps. We came down pit road. Things didn't go the way we wanted to go on pit road, and we lost the race. And the guy who did win the race was not the fastest car. He wouldn't have won it in really any other criteria except for that one. And I look at that and say, that was not a race I would have been proud to win of. And that same group is the same group that didn't embrace the format. It's almost like they knew they had lost their advantage. So, interesting.
Back to the drivers' council. What are the dynamics of those meetings like? What's the tenor like? And I'm curious, Brad, because I mean, you said in 2012 you won the championship in part because you were able to, as you said, move the needle from a team perspective to a NASCAR perspective to ensure fair play on something that was going on with another team. When you get this collaborative with an industry, can you still have those kinds of politics and have those sorts of storylines?
Yeah, I would argue you probably have more politics.
Really? All right, well, good, because I enjoy covering those types of storylines, and I fear, I guess I'm asking you to convince me, like, when things get too collaborative, is that, can that be a bad thing in a sport?
Absolutely.
That's built on this?
Yeah, when things get too collaborative amongst drivers, it can be an awful thing. I think we've seen that many, many times. But I would think that the gains made here would by far supplement any potential loss by having collaborative driver efforts.
Okay. And what's it like in those meetings? Is it contentious? Is it fiery?
You know, this is the second year of it, and I wasn't around the first year. I was told there were a lot of contentious moments the first year, but I didn't witness it firsthand.
Yeah.
And I would say that there are always going to be a handful of contentious moments, no matter what or who's involved. But I think for the most part, they're really well organized. There's a good team that's kind of leading the ship on that. And they're very thought-provoking. As drivers, and I'll be the first one to raise my hand, sometimes we're guilty of thinking we have the best idea and the only idea.
Yeah.
And then someone will say something, and you'll go, oh, God, I didn't even think of that. And it's either that was really good or that's why my idea won't work.
Yeah.
And sometimes there's a lot of swallow your pride moments where you realize, you know what, I don't have the best idea here.
Yeah.
So that balance is pretty interesting.
And so you feel like no danger in terms of that whole cunning, as you've called it, spy versus spy.
There's always going to be a little bit of that. There have already been a few moments where, you know, sometimes you have to spill the beans on something that you don't really want to spill the beans on, but it's for the betterment.
Yeah.
And that's really tough.
2 years ago, you were looking hard at leveraging your brand into affecting change through like a Ken Block style video approach. Are you still looking at those sorts of things?
We are. We're just struggling to move the needle on it at all. You know, it takes the right partner and the right funding and all those different pieces, and we just haven't been able to put it together. Not because we're not capable of it, but or not because I don't think I'm capable of it, but the efforts of mass scale that it takes to, you know, put things like that on are so cost prohibitive that you can't do them without sponsorship, which is really a shame. It's kind of one of the shames in general in our world right now. Anything that's great to do, you have to kind of sell out to do.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But it is what it is.
You invested a ton of money, obviously, into this new truck shop and just finished the expansion.
Yes.
Is that... And,
well, I would say, let me back up on that. We're about 85% on the finishing the expansion, only because I'm kind of... I put the brakes on the last 15.
When you talk about being limited in terms of like doing a your own type of Gymkhana thing because of funding or being able to find somebody who can do it and that... I guess those hard questions you have to ask about staying, you know, what you do about your principles or selling out or that sort of thing to pay for stuff. That truck shop, you've invested some serious coin now.
Yep.
Can it pay for itself long term? Do you have the same questions?
I have some pretty big questions about that. Yeah. You know, the business model in the second and third tier of NASCAR is not a profitable one, nor should it be. In my mind, it never really has been. You can really only hope to sustain. Now, at the top tier, it should be a profitable model. And I would make a little bit of an argument that in any sport, the second and third tier is usually not very profitable. We got a long road to hoe, but I don't think my goal for that was to be profitable. Of course, I don't want to lose any money.
Right.
But my goal for that unit was to, or for the truck efforts in general, was multifold. You know, I wanted to play a role in helping develop other drivers and pay it forward, not just drivers, but crew members, and pay it forward as it was paid to me by, you know, a lot of people that invested in my career, whether it be Dale Jr. or my family or whoever, even Roger. So I love the idea and concept of paying it forward, and I think that's something you do in action. And the truck team gives me that opportunity. So I love that. I love having kind of the insight on the operations of what it takes to make a race team go around. I feel like I'm a better leader within my own cup efforts because of that. I think I have a more in-depth analysis and a lot better context for different things that might happen. So that part's fun. And then, of course, playing a role in continuing the sport that my family had and being one of the original owners in the truck series. I enjoy that too. Right. It's a good series.
Speaking of your family, we're going to wrap this up with the whole reason I pitched this podcast to David Hovis, which was that this weekend is Michigan race weekend. So always homecoming for you. I was reading Rolling Stone, Brad, over the weekend. They did an interview with Kid Rock recently, and they asked him, what's the most Detroit thing about you? And he said that he thought the most Detroit thing about him was maybe my work ethic, knowing how to get back up when being kicked down. And I thought, that kind of sounds like something another guy I know from Michigan might say. What would you say is the most Detroit thing, or Michigan thing, or Rochester Hills thing
really
about Brad
Keselowski? It's hard to explain to people that have never been to Detroit or even have been to Detroit but didn't grow up there. But in Detroit, it seems like, and this always comes off as sounding crappy because no one ever wants to hear how someone else is working harder than them. no one ever wants to hear how lucky they are to have it the way they have it.
Yes.
But in Detroit, I can tell you that it's very inherent to that community that you know, your work ethic must be at a very high level.
Mm-hmm.
Your work standards must be at a very high level. Now, there are, of course, other shortcomings to that area, but that's not one of them. Work ethic there is as high or higher than I've seen anywhere in my travels or time on this earth. And so, to his point, I would say that that is a very Detroit thing, that I feel guilty being a race car driver because of it. I do. I feel,
because you don't feel like you put you did put in the work, though.
Yeah, no, it's not that. You know, growing up, my dad, of course, I got to go to the race shop when I was of ample age. But even before that, I mean, he works 6 days a week and sometimes seven and, you know, usually 8 till 7 or 8 till 8 and a lot of times more than that. And so that is just the culture of that community in that area. And in some ways, I think it's great. In some ways, I look back at it and go, God, Dad, why didn't you take a break? You know, why did, you didn't have to do that.
Yeah.
But
that's the way they do there.
Yeah, and in retrospect, knowing the things I know now, because of course you don't know a lot of things when you're younger, I remember my dad doing things that I look at now and say, I would never do that. You know, when he would build the race cars, he would fabricate all the parts himself. I mean, every part. Started out as a block of metal or a hunk of metal or, you know, piece of sheet metal, and form it, fit it, weld it, grind it, sand it, machine it, whatever you had to do, he would do all those things. And there's this one example that sticks out in my mind, that my dad taught me how to make brackets. And one day he had me, he said, here's a bracket. I want you to go trace it out on this piece of really thick steel. And so I traced out, I said, trace out, you know, 50 or 100 of them, you pick, and you go and you trace them out. He goes, okay, I'll take it to the saw and cut them out. And so you take them on the saw and you cut them out, and it's tedious,
right?
Really tedious. And you get done with, you know, probably a stack of 10, and here, take them over here. And he would take a welder and he would weld all the brackets together so that they were kind of lined up. And then he would drill one big hole in it so the hole was really similar. Then, okay, now we're going to take it over to the grinder and make them all the same perfect shape with the same hole. And there, now we'll have a, you know, a selection of 50 to 100 of these tabs for whatever. Could have been holding the radiator in or holding the brace on the body, whatever. And, okay, you do that. And now, being like 16, 17 years old and, of course, just learning, like, that was an all-day job. Like,
yeah.
And one where you used all these different machines, and you drilled, and you wore out drill bits, and you used the sander, and you wore out the sanding disc, and you used the bandsaw, and you almost cut your fingers off because you didn't know what you were doing. And you left with 50 of these small brackets. I didn't know any different at the time. And when I left Michigan and I got to North Carolina, I remember one of the first things is I saw this Ziploc baggie of these things for sale somewhere. And there was 50 for like $5. And I didn't have any context when I was, you know, in my teens doing that. But now that I'm, you know, or was at that time in my 20s, now I'm in my 30s. But at that time in my 20s, I was like, wait a minute, I spent all day on that.
Yeah.
You could buy that for $5. Where someone has cut it with a laser and it's already perfect. You didn't have to do it by hand. So I looked at a lot of those things, and I kind of relate that back to kind of that ethic. But my dad always had this pride factor where he said, I'll work longer and do it myself. I'm not buying things.
Right.
And so there's a work ethic and a pride factor that I think was the most Detroit thing about him. And I still have that in me to some extent, but never as hardcore as my dad did.
Did you ever bring that up with Bob, that hey did you know that they sold these things $5 per
that
50?
Conversation is a non-starter, because he would look at me and say, that's because you're spoiled and you don't work hard enough, you know. That's what he would say.
Yeah.
And he would give me that look like, you don't take any pride in your work.
Yeah.
And I would look at him and say, yeah, but I can do 10 other things in that time and make more than that kind of money.
Right.
to buy those little $5 brackets.
Right.
And so it's just the way it is.
What is it like when you're back in Michigan for race weekend? Do you ever just cruise over to Rochester Hills on a Saturday after practice?
There's an old saying, I think it was F. Scott Fitzgerald, that when you leave home and come back, everything looks different and you think everything's changed. But really over time, what you learn is you that's changed.
Yeah.
It's your perception that's changed. And that's how I feel every time I come back. Like, oh, this is different. Oh, that's different. Wow, this is different. And it hits you on, so many different levels.
Yeah.
And over time, you realize that it's really not the town or the community that's changing to some respects, but it's mostly you.
Although downtown Rochester Hills has changed, right?
It has some change, but not a lot.
Penny Black wasn't around 20 years ago, right?
Yeah. There's small things, but the general broad context, no, it's the same.
Yeah.
It's the same.
So you have a daughter now. Do you ever wish, Brad, that sometimes maybe you could raise Scarlett in the same way you were raised as a Michigan Derby?
Yeah.
Because I would think she's probably going to grow up with some different ideals.
Oh, I worry about it. Yeah, I worry about it. I don't think you raise boys and girls the same way. So
definitely not.
I'm trying to use that as maybe a scapegoat. But she's going to have lots of dolls, and maybe one day, even though I'm fighting it as hard as possible, her mom will convince me to get her a pony. But that'll be the retirement tour.
Just like Jeff Gordon.
Yeah, I'll try to get on that page, Jeff. But no, please don't give me a pony. I do worry that she won't be raised the same way. And one of the things that my friends from Michigan and I love to say all the time is how lucky we were and are to be from Michigan. And, it's something that we don't take for granted. I feel like it gave me a huge advantage on life.
Yeah. Scarlett, I noticed on Twitter, is she officially walking? I know you were...
She walks when she wants to.
Okay.
Yeah.
So did you get to enjoy that moment when you got back?
No, I didn't. Okay. She didn't want to. I tried. Like, all she did was sit down and cry.
Okay.
I guess that's part of being a parent.
So you still have, though, another, 36 hours or so that before you leave for Michigan that she could
start walking? Yeah, okay. Absolutely, yeah. So I got video of it the first time, even though I wasn't there. So
okay.
I have the video.
Okay. All right.
And I don't know what defines walking either. Is taking 2 or 3 steps and falling walking?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I think this is sort of like defining a thing.
Yeah, I think that's trying to walk.
Yeah, I think so. I think walking without falling probably would be.
Oh well, geez, I might be eliminated from that.
No, I'm not a parent, so how would I know? I mean,
I'm 32 years old and I walk and fall all the time.
I want to do whatever like allows you to be able to witness it for the first time, where you can say, "Oh yeah, there she was walking for the first time."
Yeah, no, that part hasn't happened. I mean, unless you count the video, but.
All right. Well.
Yeah. Soon.
Wish you luck with being around for that moment, and thanks again so much for doing this, Brad. Really appreciate all
glad
your
to be on
time.
I've listened to quite a few of these, not maybe fully, but this one I'll have to listen to in fullness because that's the way this thing goes.
This one might be my longest one, so again, appreciate it.
No problem.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Again, we appreciate Brad Keselowski for joining us on the NASCAR and NBC podcast and being gracious with his time. A big thanks as well to David Hovis, the PR manager at Team Penske, who handles Brad's media schedule and worked hard to coordinate this interview. Thanks as well to Tess Quinlan for producing the podcast. This and other episodes of the NASCAR and NBC podcast are available on Stitcher because of Tess. I recently discovered the Stitcher app on my iPhone and recommend giving it a shot. Stitcher was kind enough to feature last week's Mark Martin podcast on its front page and has lots of other good content available. You also can subscribe to the NASCAR and NBC podcast on iTunes for automatic downloads of new episodes. We'll have another new episode next week. I don't want to jinx the guests, but it will have a Hawkeye State theme with the Xfinity Series headed to Iowa Speedway next week. Thanks again for listening to the NASCAR and NBC podcast. Hope you enjoyed it.